Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. For a dozen years, a nonprofit called the Samaritan Women offered a new life to women who had been trafficked into the sex trade. At a peaceful campus in southwest Baltimore, it gave shelter, protection, counseling, education, job training, and other supports until the young women could stand on their own. By 2018, about 24 women at a time were there, turning their lives around. Then the Samaritan Women changed course, from directly embracing and supporting women's exit from the trafficked life to teaching others how to do this work. In 2019, the Samaritan Women graduated its last client in Baltimore, and now it's moved to the Midwest, deep into sharing what it learned in Baltimore about thwarting traffickers and correcting the damage they've done. In a few minutes, we'll meet someone from one of the new shelters the Samaritan Women is mentoring, about to open on the Eastern Shore. Right now, the Samaritan Women's founder and CEO, Jean Allert, joins us to talk about its change of direction. Welcome back to On the Record, Jean.
Thank you, Sheila.
Why did you start the Samaritan Women to begin with?
It was not something of my choosing. I would say that it was one of those God calls on my life because I was involved in internet consulting in Washington, D.C. at the time and had what turned out to be a fateful encounter with a survivor on the streets of Baltimore. And that planted in me such a anger about this social injustice, such a compassion for the women who are caught in this, and then such a curiosity about where there were services to help individuals in this difficult situation. And the more I studied, the more I realized there was very little to offer. And that was in part keeping them trapped. And so that was the impetus that led to my saying, well, then let's start something. And I acquired the property in Southwest Baltimore, and we began what was the first restorative care program for victims of trafficking in the Mid-Atlantic. And that was back in 2007.
And the name is from the New Testament story of Jesus meeting a woman and telling her truths about her past that she was not owning up to. What does that have to do with trafficking?
First, the way that Jesus encountered the woman served for us a model of the way that we wanted to be in relationship with them. And it was a position of non-judgment. Even in the story, she says, he knows everything I've ever done. And we wanted to be able to take that same stance with women and say, it doesn't matter where you've been or what you've experienced. We want to receive you as you are. And we also want you to leave that encounter changed. When she runs back to Samaria and becomes the first disciple, she literally is embodying a new life. And so it really became emblematic of the work that we wanted to do and the type of posture that we wanted to have in the lives of these survivors.
How many women went through the program in Southwest Baltimore?
By the time we shifted gears, we had 107 women.
And I know each of them has a unique story, but help us understand. Give us some sense of what most of them learned of the changes they made.
I think one of the things that we learned together, because none of us came in with expertise in this area, so survivors very much became our teachers as well. And what we learned together is that the chief need of survivors is to be in community. And they, you know, an exploited person is living in many ways in a dark world, in a secretive world. Prostituted people are shunned. And so they live in tremendous isolation. And we learned over the years that all of the therapeutic interventions are fine and good. But if you don't reconnect folks with society and help them find their place and their purpose in the world, they will continue in cycles of abuse. So we have a tremendous focus on helping them reacclimate to regular society, finding their place, finding what the purpose is for their life based on the experiences they've had and the gifts that they were given as a child of God.
Pick one and tell me what she's gone on to do.
Oh my gosh, so many exciting stories. You know, we have women who've become nurses People who gravitate towards helping professions. I think a lot of it is because they're very good actually with people. So the helping professions tend to be attractive. But by the same token, we've also had women who have become truck drivers, who become forklift operators, accountants. We have some that are working in retail. I've just had a number of delightful pleasures. Having done this work for over a decade, we now have had a chance to see the long view of their road to a new life. And I've had the privilege to, for example, walk somebody down the aisle who had no parents and or no parents who were able to do that. And so to see her life become so restored that she could love again and that she could have those things that she thought she could never have, like a husband, a marriage, and she just bought her first house. And she's been employed and she continues to get promoted within her employer. And those are all really exciting milestones to see, you know, for anybody, but especially exciting when you realize how far she's come.
So you were changing lives. It sounds like you were doing what you set out to do. Why did you decide? To change course?
Well, you know, what's interesting, it almost became an appetite for doing more. There's something very captivating about walking alongside somebody in life transformation. And as we were studying since 2016, we've been studying this landscape nationally. And we got to a point where we realized through intensive research across the country that there are only today 213 programs like ours across the country. And that equates to about 2,000 beds. The number of survivors across America is unknown, but there are estimates anywhere from 300,000. I mean, the state of Texas estimates 79,000 children just in that state alone who are sexually exploited. So we know there's a tremendous gap. And I think, Sheila, really that's what became the burden on our hearts is if we are seeing this volume just within our immediate area, we became aware of how big the problem is nationally with 9 states that have no shelter program whatsoever and 8 states that have only one. And we could do more. We realized we could do more. And so it became a shift to take what we've been given and what we've learned and share that with others so they could reach into areas and to survivors that we would not be able to reach.
That's Jean Allert, PhD, founder and CEO of the Samaritan Women. On the record on WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about the nonprofit's new focus on training other groups to shelter children and women caught up in trafficking. One of the groups being mentored by the Samaritan Women is on Maryland's Eastern Shore in Cambridge. It's called Harriet's House, and its founder, Julie Kane, joins our conversation. Welcome, Julie.
Thank you.
Julie, what is your vision for Harriet's House?
The vision for Harriet's House is to open up a residential program that would be similar to what the Samaritan Women was doing in Baltimore.
Where do things stand now?
Currently, we have a drop-in center that's open in the city of Cambridge, where we allow women from the community to come in to receive resources. And then we get them connected to the resources that they need that we cannot provide for them. And we are renovating a house that will become the home for residents, hopefully this spring.
And what's behind the name Harriet's House?
Harriet's House comes from Harriet Tubman. She was a woman who followed after God with everything within her to help set captives free, to help end slavery. And we chose that name because we are doing the same type of work in helping to set slaves free, but it's modern day slavery, which is human trafficking.
Julie, what is your biggest challenge right now?
I would say funding would be the biggest challenge because it's an ongoing need. And in order to employ the staff that we'll need for the residential program, it does cost a lot of money.
And Jean, what tends to be the biggest stumbling block to a group trying to start a shelter?
The most significant and recurring challenge that shelters have is bringing in staffing that is appropriate for the work. It's extraordinarily demanding work, emotionally, spiritually, sometimes physically. It's a lifestyle. It's not a job. And we're seeing in our field that the, if you will, the shelf life of somebody who is a caregiver in this role might be about a 10 to 12 year span because it is so demanding emotionally. You know, you're sitting with trauma all day long and the effects of trauma and hearing some pretty horrendous stories. So I'd say across the field, attracting appropriate staff, people who have that kind of grounding and maturity and stability to be able to be present with those who are in recovery and in their brokenness is hugely important. But funding is also something that I would say all nonprofits struggle with. One of the things that I'm incredibly proud to report is that much like homeless shelters, very few of the trafficking shelters across the United States shut down during the lockdowns. They had to change some of their protocols, but our work never ends. You know, homelessness doesn't sleep, so to speak. And so that speaks to the commitment that we have to do the work and to the population, but it also speaks to the demands and how funding has to continue and being present has to continue.
Julie, I guess I am so firmly rooted in the I-95 corridor that that's how my mind frames trafficking. I mean, I think of Cambridge as sort of off the beaten path. Are there many people there who need Harriet's House?
Yes, there are people that need residential care all across the United States, no matter what location, if it's rural or if it's urban, the need is prevalent everywhere. I think it can be hidden more in rural areas than it is in urban areas, but it is a need that is across the board.
Describe to me the kind of clients you're coming in contact with, who you envision when you open a residence. Who will be there?
So we had a spa that was busted in our area that was you know, not really a spa. So there were women there that needed housing and care that they didn't have a place to go. And so we've had different types of encounters with law enforcement and hospital personnel that were looking for women that were in need of care.
Part of the thing that we also have to consider about a place like the Eastern Shore is the transient populations that you will have seasonally. So you'll have, you know, coming through in the summer, you'll have tourism, you'll have vacationing, you can even have labor trafficking individuals who will go through particular areas of the state of Maryland, as well as in other states. And so it can be individuals who are residents of that area, but trafficking can also, with proper drop-in services and community awareness, be available to people who are passing through.
Jean, you're mentoring groups like Julie's across the country. When you look ahead, say, 5 years, what do you think the trafficking picture in the U.S. will look like?
It's an excellent question because it's changing very fast, largely enabled by technology, and I would say aggravated also by the lockdowns. And here's what I mean, is we are seeing already an uptick in digital exploitation and also self-exploitation. Now, there isn't a better term for that, but what we're seeing is a uptick in kids who have access to a phone, who are perhaps being molested in the home or are in abuse situations, poverty situations. And there are so many tools available online now to children and young adults to exploit themselves, whether that's a girl who's in the privacy of her own bedroom or bathroom and she's on a camming site and she's being paid by anonymous people to do things on camera. And so that's exploitation of a minor, but there's no physical contact between those individuals. So it still fits the definition of exploitation, but it's being enabled completely by technology. And so it is a commercial transaction involving a minor, you know, for a sexual exchange. So that's a huge area that we haven't even begun to imagine as a nation, what the consequences are to that individual. Do we call her a victim? How do we, where, who really is the criminal in that case? How do we have an interdiction in a crime like that? And what are the far-reaching implications in terms of abuse on that individual, psychic abuse, as well as any other form? So I would say that's probably the biggest looming change that we are seeing. But across the United States, we've now had, I believe, 9 states that have proposed the decriminalization of prostitution. And that will have far-reaching social implications, because now I can speak in terms of this being a crime. But if we go to full legalization of prostitution in a state or across this country, then it's no longer a crime. And what happens to the victim? They're no longer a victim. What happens to the mandated services and the government appropriations for victims of crime? Does all of that go away? Because now we interpret this as a willful act, not a criminal act. So I would say that we're, not to be hyperbolic, but we are really at a point where we're going to see a considerable change in what exploitation looks like in this country, largely if we don't do anything about it.
It's a sobering picture. I'm grateful to you for talking to us about it. I'm grateful to both of you. Thank you.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
Jean Allard is founder and CEO of The Samaritan Women, a nonprofit that used to shelter trafficked women in Baltimore and now trains groups across the U.S. in that fight. Julie Crane is working to launch Harriet's House in Cambridge, Maryland, one of the groups The Samaritan Women is mentoring. At the On the Record page at WYPR.org, we have links to both organizations and to a Telly Award-winning video of Allard explaining The Samaritan Women's new work.